This morning I'm going to talk to you on the subject, The Anatomy of a Father, or Who Retarded Papa? And this afternoon, my resident expert is going to speak on the subject, The Anatomy of a Mother, Who Cloned Mother? And then tonight we're going to talk about conflict in marriage, something that most of you have never faced, but three or four recommended that we talk about this subject. It was a personal area of need. The average American father is a highly frustrated individual, and not without reason. He's like a one-armed paper hanger suffering from a severe case of the hives. It's 5:30 in the afternoon. He has three rooms yet to paper, and he ran out of paste. He's like a severe amnesia victim, walking around crying, "Who am I?" You see, it's easy to become a father biologically. That really doesn't take that much. But it's difficult to become a father psychologically, emotionally, spiritually. And in our culture, there's very little that prepares you for that role. There isn't a man in this room that went to a university and was graduated with a major in parenting. You didn't come up with a certificate. You didn't appear before a board that approved you and said, "You're a qualified father." In fact, most of us never even had a crash course in Fatherhood 101. And yet God has given to us the sobering responsibility of handling 20 plus years of a child's life. Build into that child's life physically, emotionally, socially, intellectually, and spiritually. What an assignment. And the assignment is greatly complicated by the fact that you are compelled to live in this generation because you have very few role models, very few templates to which you can look for direction. There's a book that I could wish every man in this room would read. Don't get derailed by the title. The title is Passive Men, Wild Women. It's written by a distinguished psychiatrist on the West Coast by the name of Pierre Mornell, M-O-R-N-E-L-L. And in the introduction to that book, he writes these words. Over the last few years, I have seen in my office an increasing number of couples who share a common denominator. The man is active, articulate, energetic, and usually successful in his work. But he is inactive, inarticulate, lethargic, and withdrawn at home. In his relationship to his wife, and I might add his family, he is passive. And his passivity drives her crazy. In the face of his retreat, she goes wild. Can I take just a minute to analyze the dynamics of our culture for you? You You see, you are responsible as a man primarily for functioning in two critical areas. First of all and foremost, you need to function at home with a wife, with a set of children, if God graces your family with such a gift. But you also need to function on the job. You got to keep body and soul together. You got to make a living. You have a responsibility to support that wife and those children. Now, this is what happens in the process. As you attempt some kind of involvement with that home, you discover that you are really very weak. Not too well adjusted, not really competent, and often very insecure. As a result, you begin to experience some degree of failure. And sometimes, by the way, this doesn't show up until your kids become parents, become teenagers. See, I think the average person's competence as a parent is in direct proportion to the age of their children. You know, for the first 11 and 12 years, you know, I need no problems. I just tell them, jump, BS, how high. In fact, I don't know why we have these seminars. They want to know how to do it? Let them show up on my doorstep. I'll tell them. Then the kid becomes a teenager and everything hits the fan. The guy's competence is totally decimated. Everything he knew for the first 12 years, he's out to lunch on now. But you see, in the meantime, he is becoming very strong in his work. Because that's what experience is all about. That's what wisdom is all about. It isn't that you're that brilliant or that sharp. It's just that you've lived that long. You know, you get smart. You just hang around a company long enough when you know more than anybody else in the outfit. So then they make you president. Plus the fact that whereas you are a failure there, you are a success over here. You keep climbing the ladder. You are confident over here. You are secure over here. And everybody sings your praises. See, nobody gives you brownie points for functioning as a father. You notice that? And the interesting thing is, everybody asks you, what do you do? I think I'd drop through a manhole if I asked a guy one day, hey, man, what do you do? And he said, I'm a father. Because most of us would say, yeah, really, what do you do? Well, I'm a husband. Yeah, so am I, five times over. So you see what's beginning to happen. He's failing over here. He's succeeding over here. Therefore, he spends increasingly more of his time and his energy over here, where he's succeeding. And because he is, he's spending increasingly less time over here where he's failing. So the more time goes by, the more he is failing over here, and he is succeeding over here. That's what Mornell was talking about. So he becomes passive over here. I had a girl at the seminary married to one of our students, who told me one day after one of our evening sessions with the wives, she said, Pratt, my father is a leader. He is a leader in business, always has been. He is a leader in the church. He's an elder. He is a leader in the community. But he's out to lunch when he comes home. And ladies and gentlemen, we are paying the highest price tag
for passive men and wild women.
Now, what is a father?
Well, you get many answers to that exciting question. One of my favorite sets of answers comes in a little children's book. It's entitled, What is a Father? A gal, I think, up in New York State, gave an assignment to her children in her class, asking them to define what a father is and accompany it with some appropriate childlike art. So here are a few of them. My father could have been a Bart star, but he had to support his family. A father, he is someone whom every married mother hates to lose. How about this one? Most fathers would like to help out, but they just can't. What is a father? That's why I'd like to answer for you for just a few moments this morning. I'd like to show you that an effective father is a marked man. He is an individual who is branded, and although his personality and his gifts and many other things in his life may take a variety of forms, he will always have these five marks. And the more these marks are true of him, the more effective he is as a father. Why don't you jot them down? And it'll give you an opportunity to do some reflection. Because after all, ultimately, each of us as fathers has to answer this question. Now, I want to tell you right at the outset, I'm not interested in hanging a guilt trip on you. You need more guilt, gentlemen, like you need another hole in the head. But you need a lot of guidance. And I want to see if I can help you in that direction. So please note, we are not talking about somebody who has arrived. We are talking about someone who has a clear set of objectives, who knows what it takes to be a good father, and who is consciously moving in that direction. With the truth of Philippians 4:13 deeply ingrained in his mentality. I can do all things, including fathering, through Christ, which strengtheneth me. The first unmistakable mark of a good father is he is an individual with a strong priority system. With a strong priority system. Now, I don't need to tell you that there is no conflict of duty in Christian experience. You see, your call to be a father is not in conflict with your call to be a business or professional man. Objectives always determine outcomes. You achieve that for which you aim. And if you don't know where you're going, then any road will get you there. I saw a fascinating definition of a fanatic some years ago. It said a fanatic is a person who redoubles his efforts after he has lost sight of his goals. Oh, I love that. And by the way, when you lose sight of your goals, then you concentrate on motion. But it's motion without meaning. Now, every individual man must face his priorities in four areas. First of all, in the personal realm. Your primary task in life is to maintain personal and spiritual integrity. That has to do with your character. I wish I could shout this from the housetops to every man in our generation. What you are is far more important than what you do.
Because what you are will determine
what you do. We were conducting some leadership workshops in the Washington area for a number of executives, some of whom were connected with various departments of the United States government and the military. And during one of our coffee breaks, a man in a high-ranking position in the government came to me and said, "You know, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the spiritual input of the seminar." He said, "I'm so weary of attending workshops and seminars on professional competence where we teach men all of the basic principles of management." He said, "Because I've discovered that if you teach an individual all of the basic principles of management without character, you simply enable him to be a better ripoff artist." And that's what we are witnessing in our society. Better method, but foggy goal. You see, every man in this room has to come to grips with a very searching realization. You've got a wife, you've got one or more children who are looking to you as a pace setter. And I don't know about you, but that's a sobering assignment. To realize I am providing a model for my wife, for my four children, now eight of them, all four are married. And I've discovered at this stage of the game with our children, 26, 28, 30, and 32, they are perhaps looking as much or more now for my modeling than in any period in my parenting role. And we've got to ask ourselves, men, a very searching question. What do I have to give my children? Ladies and gentlemen, you cannot impart what you do not possess. If you don't have it, you can't give it. I've been trying to sell hair-restoring oil for 30-some years. And you know, I haven't sold a bottle in the last 32 of them. And that's what happens in parenting, you see. Many times we're trying to sell spiritual hair restoring oil, and we're as bald as can be. Now, that's where it all starts, but it doesn't end there. There is a second area in which you need to function, and that's the marital area. And by the way, I want you to mark the connection between these. You see, if you don't have it personally, what do you have to give to your marriage? I have guys come into my office all the time and say, "Well, I tell you, you should see what I'm married to." A guy came into my office not too long ago. He said, "Hendricks, I ain't getting much out of this marriage. Man, if you don't think I rotted his socks." I said, "Man, I got news for you. You're not supposed to get anything out of your marriage." "I'm not." "No, what I'm really concerned about is what are you giving to your marriage?" See, the problem with marriage is people. You know, unless you dump it on somebody else, you're one of them. So you get two persons with problems and you bring them together and you've got a problem partnership. See, the problems of the individual are the problems of the couple. And by the way, may I say to you that in my judgment, this is the number one problem in America today. It's not the one that's featured, and that's the breakdown of the home. Greatest symptom of the sagging American culture is the breakdown of marriage. Because once the marriage goes, it's just a question of time before the family goes. And I hope, as we tried to point out last night, that one half of your marriage without children just burns itself right into the center of your consciousness. See, it takes an awful lot to make a good marriage. I kid you not. I would be intellectually dishonest if I told you, you can have a good marriage, but it won't cost you anything. I was with a group of men some time ago. I said, gentlemen, if you had not spent any more time or had any more expertise in your business or profession than you are spending or have with respect to your marriage, well, what happened? A guy in the front row just yelled out, it's full tomorrow. I said, thanks, sir. I appreciate your honesty. He made the point. See, why are we successful in our business or profession? I'll tell you why. There's no exception. You really make a serious investment. Now, we'll come back to this in a moment, but I want you to see a third area. And that's the parental area. And again, mark the connection. See, if you don't have it personally, you don't have it maritally. And if you don't have your act together maritally, what in the world do you think you are doing parentally? See, the greatest contribution you have to make to your children is the quality of your marriage. And by the way, we asked how many of you are parents of teenagers, and I discover we got a juicy collection of them here. Wow, what a secure group of people. Show up at a seminar like this. Do you ever express your love to your partner in the presence of your teenagers? By the way, that's one of the greatest heritages you'll ever give them. Oh, I don't evaluate it on the basis of the kids' evaluation. Because every time you embrace, oh, no. Tons sickening. Yeah. My wife and I were embracing in the living room some years ago, and my younger son, Bill, came plowing through the front door with his buddy from down the street. And he saw us embracing and said to his friend, hey, we're going to have to wait a minute. Skip said, how come? I see my parents are in there smooching. Skip said, well, let's go in. I said, it always goes on in our house. Boy, Bill looks at that kid. And that kid looks back at him and said, boy, Bill, must be fantastic to have a father that loves your mother. I don't even know who my father is. Every night, we got a different guy in that house. Must be fantastic to have a father that loves your mother. And ladies and gentlemen, to a little kid who's brought up in a home where he takes that for granted, he gets a liberal arts education crammed right down the center of his throat. I repeat, the greatest thing you can do for your children is to love your children's mother. See, there are some of us who came from a different background. I know what it is to come from a broken home. I know what it is to cry myself asleep at night, never sure where I'd wake up the next morning. I know what it is to hear my father's sister say, hey, what in the world did you bring that kid in here for? I know what it is to get reamed out in the home and go out to talk to my dog. I was also always so glad I had Blizz. Blizzard was my Eskimo dog. The reason I loved him is that the guy always understood. You know, I'd go out and pour out my woes to him, and he'd just wag his tail. So that's okay, Howie, just you and me, man, all the way. I'd be crying, he'd lick my tears away. And how in the world was I to know he liked salt? And I suspect that most of you here this morning are really concerned about the marriage of your children. I hope you are. I'll give you something that will contribute more to the significance and quality of your children's marriage than anything else. And that is that those kids grow up in a home where they know that my mother and my father are incurably, unashamedly in love with each other. That's the greatest heritage you will ever give them. Now there's a fourth area, and that is what we might call the professional, vocational component. And again, I want you to know where it is. You see, we're having some very interesting times in America today, for your information. Productivity level at the lowest point in our history. And everybody's screaming. I had a guy call me up some time ago and said, "Hendricks, will you come down, conduct a seminar on a certain subject?" I said, "No, I'm sorry. I'm not spending my time doing that." He said, "Well, you name the price." I said, "Look, it isn't a question of price. I just don't have time, and that's not my objective." "Oh, you come down. I'll give you $5,000 a day to come down." I said, "Man, you really are serious." He said, "I've never been more serious." He said, "This thing is just falling apart right under me." Well, I'll give you a little insight as to our problem of productivity. We've got a collection of people in America without character. They have no value. We got a group of people who are kicking the slats out of their marriage. We got a group of people who think that parenting is priority 28 on a list of 25. And we can't figure why, professionally and vocationally, we're not pulling it off. You see, my friends, the greatest thing you have to contribute on the job, in your profession, is your personal integrity, it's your marital unity, it's your parental competency and commitment, and it's out of these that we produce a group of people who go to work to work and are fulfilled in the process. We spend all our time saying, "Oh boy, TGIF, thank God it's Friday." Every radio program in Dallas comes on every Friday morning with TGIF. You know why? Because everybody, you know, dinks around in a job for 5 days. "Well, oh boy, it's Friday." Because now we're coming to the big bash. Saturday and Sunday, so that by Thursday we're beginning to sober out, so we can make another one. And what I'm asking you is, nobody's trying to cram anything down your throat. But where do you stand in terms of the priority? And I hate to tell you this, but you are a qualitative audience. It happens to be true in our society that your church and the evangelical community in general won't necessarily help you pull that off. Especially your commitment to your marriage and your family. See, I know that because as a young man growing up in a ministry, I used to have people call me up and say, "Brother Henry, would you come over and preach for us?" "No, I'm sorry, I can't come." "You know, you can't come? How come?" "Well, I'm busy." "Oh, you preaching somewhere else?" "No, I'm not preaching anywhere else." "What are you doing?" "I'm going to stay home and play with my kids." "You what?" "I'm going to stay home and play with my kids. Is that all right?" Huh. I can almost hear it on the other end of the phone. You know, that's how liberalism gets started in the seminaries. And I listen to that baloney and wipe four kids out of the saddle so that somebody says, "Who wants to listen to him?" See, ladies and gentlemen, if you do not make your decisions in terms of your priorities, somebody else will make them for you. But they may not have the priority. And the result is that even the Christian community can bend you out of shape You're going to have to sit down and say, Lord, what do you want me to do? And make that kind of a commitment. And that's where a good father starts.
Now there's a second characteristic. And that is, a good father jealously guards his attitude. You know, my friends, the longer I live, the more I am convinced of the strategic nature of attitudes. I happen to believe that your attitudes are more important than your actions. Did it ever occur to you why so many times, particularly in the prophets, God is scoring the people not for their actions, but for their attitudes? He says, come to Bethel and sin. Come to the house of God and sin. Sin? You mean go to church and sin? We do it every Sunday. Bring your sacrifices. Bring your offering. And some guy could say, hey, what's God ticked off about? Didn't he tell him to bring him? Yeah, he did. But not with that attitude. For the prophet says, for this pleases you. But God is throwing up over it. See, my friends, God is not impressed with the little routines that you go through. He's still looking at a heart. That's why I love to find a father who's got the guts and the honesty to say, man, I'm dropping it all over the place. But all I want you to know is, I got a heart that's committed to God. I'll learn everything I can get my hands on. Give me all the help you got. That's a winner. See, it's not a person who's got it all together. It's a person who's struggling in the process, but knows that God never calls us to a task without giving us the resources with which to pull it off. I saw a sign in a businessman's office some time ago. It said, you are not what you think you are. What you think, you are. See, that's why the scripture says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. That's why the scripture says, keep thy heart with all diligence. Why? Because out of it are the issues of life. Gentlemen, have you learned the therapy of a grateful heart? Just to spend more of your time rejoicing in the Lord. I don't know what your experience is, but if you had to ride the freeways, as many of you do, you know what can happen just in the process of coming home. I mean, that's an experience to test anybody's sanctification. You know, here you are in this massive parking lot, creeping along and stopping, you know, well, we're all waving to each other, enjoying the energy crisis. And then, would you believe it, some guy cuts in on you. You know, I mean, right in front of you. And you just about climb the back. And by the time you come home, man, you bite your wife's head off. And she gets ticked off, and she runs out and reams the kids out. And the kids go, and they pull the dog's tail. And the dog goes and bites the cat. See, my friends, what you need is to develop what I call a point of no return. I'll tell you how I got it. I got it from a very astute businessman who said to me one day in my youth, he said, son, I think God is going to use you someday, but you're going to have a problem. So what do you think it is? He said, it's the problem of anybody in business, in industry, in the professions. That's the problem of your work tensions spilling over into your marriage and family. Well, I said, you faced this all your life. How do you handle it? He said, I developed a point of no return. I said, what's that? He said, I have a point on my way home from work where I drop everything in that day's activity. And I leave it there till the following morning. Now, if you come to Dallas, I'll show you that point.
Little Creek runs underneath the freeway that I use called White Rock Creek. And when I get to White Rock Creek, that's where it gets dropped. A whole ball of wax right on the freeway. I know that's bad ecologically. And you know where it is the next morning?
Nah,
it's crossed over. It crosses over the freeway overnight and waits for me. And when I come back the next day, hey, Hendricks, here we are, don't miss us. Never missed me in 30-some years.
And my friend, that's what you need. And I sense by the shaking of many of your heads, you know what I'm talking about. You see, we give the most significant people in our life the hot end of a poker. The poorest tag in our life. And that's a raping of the most serious form. You know, I guess one of the most encouraging things to me is to see the larger number of business and professional people who are, in effect, telling a company to hang it on their beak when that company is asking you to mortgage the soul of your marriage and family. We have a couple prominent surgeons down in our area, particularly down in Houston in the heart area. We have one guy who will tell you right at the front end, if you come into my residency, you mortgage your soul to me. I may tear your family apart, I may shred your marriage, but I will make you one of the great surgeons of this generation, specializing in the heart. How does he know? That's what he's done with his wife and children. And one of my closest friends, probably the most brilliant young man to come out of medical school in the state of Texas in recent years, was invited to come in for an interview. And he gave him that line. And that young kid with all of his brilliance and gift before him looked this doctor straight in the eye and said, sir, I couldn't care less about your proposal because I've got a greater commitment to my wife and to my family. And I will mortgage neither one for medicine or anything else. See, where are the men with that kind of value, with that kind of commitment? See, that's a person I can guarantee you is going to be an individual whose attitudes are Christ-like because he's got Christ-like commitment. And I'll guarantee you God will not let him down. You see, you can't do anything about your ancestors. But you can do a great deal about your descendants. And it's possible that the next generation may rise up and call you blessed. Because it was back there in 1981, I'm not sure of the month, I think it was March, that my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather went to a conference and made a set of decisions that changed the whole course of our family. He overhauled his priorities. He drastically changed his attitude. Well, let me give you a third one. You still with me? Huh? Okay, I just want to know if you're out there. People are so quiet up here. Third characteristic of an effective father is he communicates his love. You remember in the scripture reading in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, we read that remarkable statement. Fathers, do not exasperate. I love that. And the form in which this is found in the original text it can be translated in one of two ways. Stop provoking. Or it can be translated, don't get the habit. If you're not provoking your kids to wrath, don't ever get that disease. And if you are, cut it out. Do you ever ask yourself, how do you provoke your kids to wrath? Very simple. You exasperate them by one of two ways. Either by over-discipline or under-discipline. And it's an amazing thing. Most of us are creatures of extreme. You know, on the one hand, boy, we're going to beat this kid to a pulp. I tell you, son, I'm going to beat your two eyes into one. You know, we become sort of a Simon Legree. Every time the kid turns around, we nail him to the floor. Or on the other hand, you know, we swing the other side and say, I don't want to touch him. Because if I touch him, I'm liable to destroy his psyche. Johnny wants to throw a brick through a plate glass window. You let him throw it through. You never want to curb his genius for throwing bricks. And we're constantly going from one side to the other. The hardest thing is to find a father who has what someone calls the velvet brick. I love that. Soft as velvet, strong as brick, properly welded together. He says, don't exasperate. Instead, here's the option. Bring them up in the training and the instruction of the Lord. Suppose I were to ask you the question this morning, gentlemen. Do you love your children? What would you respond with? Well, I ask a lot of people that question. I had a woman in my office some time ago. I said, ma'am, do you love your son? Do I love my son? You didn't think I came up here to be asked a stupid question like that, do you? Well, I said, how does your son know that you love him? Well, I wash his clothes and I iron them and I prepare his meals. I said, how old is your son? She said, 2. I said, boy, lady, I'll bet that's a biggie. See, when I ask you, gentlemen, do you love your children, I'm asking, does your love come through at a level that those kids can understand? By the way, why don't you ask them sometime? You better be prepared. You better get yourself in an overstuffed chair. Could produce a coronary. Because kids tell it like it is. And I've had kids look a guy straight in the eye and say, man, no. The guy's crushed. See, I don't find one father in 20,000 who really at heart is trying to tear his family apart. Interesting thing, in 30-some years of counseling, I have never had a man come into my office and say, hey, Hendrick, I need your expertise. I want to know how to trash up my family. And I need some professional help. See, most of us do a pretty good job by ourselves. No, I am convinced where I sit down and get behind the facade, get to the gut of the guy, that what he really wants to be is a good father. He wants to have good kids. But often he doesn't know how to communicate that. So let me give you some help in this area. There are three primary ways by which you communicate your love to your children. Number one, you do it by time. Now, before you get wiped out with that or misunderstand what we're talking about, we are not primarily talking about amount. We are talking about quality of relationship. Please note, I am not suggesting you may not have to spend more time with your children. For your information, the average time the American middle-class father spends with his small children every day, is 37.7 seconds. The most recent study from Cornell University. So I'm not suggesting you don't need to spend more than 37.7 seconds. I'm saying that if the amount of time you are spending with your children is not qualitative, then don't multiply the mediocrity. I hate to tell you this, because you can misunderstand, but there are many parents that I have to tell, you need to spend less time with your kids. You see, their attitudes are so bitter, they have so deteriorated, that the more time they spend with a kid, the more they gross them out. So I got to spend some time getting this guy, this gal, changed, and then get him back to develop a quality relationship. Businessman was asked during Christmas, "What are you giving your son for Christmas?" He said, "I'm giving him a piece of paper." "A piece of paper?" "Yeah, let me tell you what I wrote on it. To my son, I give you 1 hour of each week and 2 hours every Sunday to be used as you wish." That's the key. You see, it's not a question of coming to a seminar like this and getting so shook up. "That's right, Eric. Thanks a lot. That's right, I got to spend more time with my boys." You know, you go home on Sunday and say, "All right, son, come on, come on. Hurry up, I don't have a lot of time to horse around." You know, Hendrick says I'm supposed to play with you. See, let's suppose next Monday you come home, your wife says, "Hey, hon, it'll be about 15, 20 minutes for dinner." And you say to your little guy, "Hey, man, what would you like to do?" "Hey, could we play ball, Dad?" "Sure, get the ball, man. I'll meet you outside. We'll go out, throw that ball around." Pretty soon, Mom says, "Okay, child, go on." "Good night, man. That's the fastest 15 minutes I've spent today." "That's right, Dad." But he got a message. For your information, some very interesting studies have been done of people who travel a great deal as fathers, representative salesmen. They do not necessarily have a poorer role in their fathering task. You see, they may be gone a great deal. The kid understands that. Most of our kids have more intelligence than we give them credit for. What they want to know is, what do you do when you do come home? Do you then choose to spend that time with that kid? Well, there's a second way that you communicate your love, and that is by your interests. And I mean here, becoming interested in the things that interest a child. I was just with a professional man. I kid you not, this guy doesn't know the front end from the back end of a car. That's a fact. We've always got to get him into the car to drive it the right way. But he's got four boys. He's got this nice little acreage. And you know, his wife is like many of our wives, sort of neurotic over cleanliness and the rest of it. You know, "Oh boy, we can't have any of these dirty cars around here." So he said, "It's okay, we'll get one of those dirty cars and we'll put it way in the backside of the property behind the tree." And he's got this bomb back there that he bought, he told me, for $25, piece of junk. And those four guys climb all over that baby. They've taken a car apart, they put it back together, they got it running, has some remaining parts left over. And I said to one of the kids when I was out there not too long ago, I said, "Hey, man, you're really having a ball out here." He said, "Yeah, Doc, and the best thing is Dad comes out and watches us. And he doesn't know schmutz about what's going on. But he bought it for us. He made it possible. And he comes out and says, 'Hey, boys, tell me what you're doing.' And we keep telling him, and he still doesn't know."
But you see, I've had a doctor friend who never could come to grips with the fact that his son would never become a doctor. In fact, he would never go to college. But he's an electronics genius. And I used to love to go there because he'd wire up his room. And he'd have the strobe lights and the music comes on, you know, and the rest of it. You step into it, everything goes out. So he'd always say, "Hey, Uncle Howie, come on up and see the room." Sure, man, and I'd be up there, boy, and these things would be going on. He'd be hiring a kite because I was paying attention to him, and Bob, Pop is downstairs tearing a scab off his ulcer. Kid's got one of the finest businesses you've ever seen in home repair. And I happen to know, for people in Indianapolis and area, you just wish you had a kid like this in your community. You could call. I will do the best job you have ever seen in putting your house back together. But he's not a doctor. You see, that's one of our problems. We want our kids to be interested in what we're interested in. You know, when you were at the college, you were the great big football stud. Well, that's been centuries ago for some of you, I can tell. Things have changed since then. You're a nice dresser, but your middle drawer is sticking out. And I've discovered working with professional athletes, the hardest thing to get these guys to choke down is that their kids could care less about athletics. But they're into science. They're into radio. They're into flying. They're into something else. And your task as a parent is to get into the skin of your kids. To find out what's interesting them. Well, the last thing I want to mention in terms of communicating your love is that you do it by listening. We talked about it last night, didn't we? And by the way, that's why your kid needs a dog. You've been having problems with that, I see. A little kid up here in Rochester, New York, wrote his first essay for a school teacher entitled, "What My Dog Means to Me." Listen to this. This is beautiful. "My dog means somebody nice and quiet to be with. He does not say do like my mother, or don't like my father, or stop like my big brother. My dog Spot and I just sit together quietly, and I like him and he likes me." Oh, I love that. That's classic. My friends, would you ever come to grips with the fact you don't need to tell your kids everything you know? Sometimes the greatest thing you do is just be there. I don't know how many kids have told me that. They say, "Does your father talk a lot?" He hardly says anything. He just enjoys being with me. And you know, I just enjoy being with him. And we get down and sit in the boat and, you know, we can't even find a fish. But he just enjoys being with me. In fact, he put his arm around me, one kid said to me not too long ago, and he just said, "Hey, son, we didn't catch any fish, but we sure had a good time, didn't we?" Did you hear the message he said? Here's the fourth thing I want to give you. And I won't be able to spend as much time on this as I'd like, but get started. A good father affirms his child in every way. He affirms his child in every way. That's why I had a brother read that very significant verse in Colossians 3:21. Fathers, same construction. Stop embittering your children. Do not get the habit of embittering your children, or they will become discouraged. I guess the reason I'm most sensitive about this, my friend, is that we get the end product of this at the seminary. For your information, all of our students are college and university graduates. Most of them have a B average or above. We are currently running anywhere from 10 to 15 points above medical schools and law schools in our entrance credentials. So I'm talking about, you know, a pretty sharp group of guys. And we had one from an Ivy League school. I'll never forget this guy. This guy has 160 IQ, which is as high as our particular instrument grows. I'm convinced he's way beyond that. I'm on the admissions committee, so we read all of the applications that come in and the references. We get a reference from this major professor at this Ivy League school who said, I've been teaching in this institution for 36 years, 32 of them as chairman of the department, and I've never seen a kid in this league, in this young man's league. And he said, I'm sorry he's going to waste his life in the ministry. This kid walks into my office one day and says, hey, Prof, I'm going to check it to you. I said, you what? He said, I'm leaving. I said, you got to be kidding. No, he said, I'm for real. I said, what in the world are you leaving it for? He said, because I really don't think I have it for the ministry. And I had the hardest time to keep from roaring in the kid's face. I thought, man, I better not tell the rest of the guys around here you don't have it. They'll all be headed for the registrar's office. I said, tell me about your family. Ah, he said, it's a bad scene. I said, tell me about your father. That's worse. I said, how come? He said, Prof, I can never remember my father telling me once in my life, that was a good job, son. I'd come home with the highest grade in the school, 98. He'd say, well, where are the other 2 points? His favorite name for me was Dummy. Did you ever get called Dummy by the most significant person in your life, despite the fact that you got 160 plus IQ and a graduate of one of the leading universities in America with the highest reference that that professor had ever written? That really is quite beside the point. My friends, if you would ever come to grips with the fact that you are the most important individual in developing your child's self-image, you would realize what a contribution you are making. How sobering is your responsibility. Let me add a fifth and last one. An effective father is a spiritually dependent individual. And I want you to write down two verses of Scripture. First, 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 7. Oh, I love this. This is a father's verse to memorize. For God has not given us a spirit of fear or frustration. Any frustrated fathers here today? Don't put your hands up. I got news for you. You're supposed to be. But there's one thing you can tell. You never got that from God. God does not frustrate you. He doesn't say, you didn't make it as a father. My friend, God is far more interested that you succeed as a father than you are. So Paul says, God has not given us a spirit of frustration, but of three things. Power, that's ability. Ability. Of love, that's compassion. And of a sound mind. You see, the secret of a disciplined child is a disciplined father. The last passage I want you to put down is Genesis. Genesis chapter 18 and verse 19. That's God's testimony of Abraham. God says, I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord. God have that kind of confidence in you? I repeat, God never calls us to any task, including the task of fatherhood, motherhood, without providing all of the resources
with which to pull it off.